I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. We begin the hour with another edition of the Midday Health Watch, our monthly conversation with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Nguyen. She'll bring us up to date on the city's continuing battle with the twin epidemics of violence and drug abuse. We'll also talk about health insurance. Record numbers of Marylanders are signing up under the Affordable Care Act. How the city's Be More for Healthy Babies initiative is giving babies a healthy start. And despite record high temperatures today, it's code blue season. How are some of our most vulnerable citizens going to stay safe this winter? Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Tina Fey's Mean Girls the Musical at DC's National Theater. Midday gets underway right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us for Midday. Today, it's another edition of the Midday Health Watch. That's our regular conversation with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Nguyen. She talks to us about the leading issues affecting our health and well-being and addresses your questions and comments about public health. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. If you have questions for Dr. Nguyen, our email, midday@wipr.org. You can always find us on Twitter, at Midday Tom Hall. Lena, it's good to see you.
Nice to see you, too. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, you are back in the saddle after giving birth to a beautiful baby. I've seen pictures, and he's as gorgeous as they come, Eli. So Eli's how old now?
Eli is 12 weeks, almost 13 weeks old, yeah. And he and my husband and I are really excited about celebrating our first Thanksgiving together.
Yeah, that'll be great. That'll just be great. You wrote a very beautiful, powerful, compelling essay right after Eli was born about your experiences initially with Eli in his very first week or so. You brought him home from the hospital, and things, as is the case with so many people, as gushy as we all get about cute little babies, babies are tough sometimes, and Eli gave you a run for your money there in the early going, and you shared that with folks on an essay you did on NPR. It's not an unusual situation. Tell us a little bit about what happened in the very early going with Eli.
Well, I brought Eli home, and I had quite an uneventful labor and delivery, thankfully. And he was healthy and just this beautiful child. My husband and I were so happy, and we couldn't wait to get home and start our lives together. When we got him home, he began crying a lot. And we thought, well, crying is normal in babies. And it actually took us a couple of days to figure out that what was happening was he wasn't latching appropriately, he wasn't latching correctly, and wasn't actually getting enough food. And he was starting to get quite jaundiced, and our pediatrician got very worried, and we almost ended up readmitting him to the hospital because of jaundice and malnutrition.
Wow.
And I felt so guilty. I mean, here I am as a physician, as a public health official. I mean, of all people who should know about how to feed a newborn, I felt like a failure on all levels, that I couldn't take care of my baby, that I couldn't do something as basic that every mom, every parent should be able to do. And I think it took me some time and perspective to realize that this is something that many parents go through, that many people go through. And that caring for a newborn takes a lot of skills and a lot of resources and support that not everyone has. I felt very privileged that I had access to a great lactation consultant at my birthing hospital, at Mercy Hospital, a fantastic pediatrician, and amazing resources. But so many people don't have that. And it made me even more committed to the work that we do in the city to care for everyone, especially our most vulnerable, but really everyone, because what's more important than caring for our babies and caring for women and families? We say that these are our core values in society. We have to
It certainly gets a lot of lip service, doesn't it? Yeah.
That's right. I mean, what politician doesn't like babies?
Yeah,
or who says
right.
that we don't want to be caring for families? And we always talk about the importance of work and the importance of family. But we have to have the policies in place to support our values that we hold so dear. And it's made me much more committed to the work that we do already, for example, with Be More for Healthy Babies, which provides these types of support for our families here in Baltimore City.
And has been pretty successful. I mean, all things considered, it's been that program has been in effect for 10 years, something like that.
That's right. The program has been around for 7-8 years, and in that period, we have reduced the percentage of children dying in, or the percentage, or the infant mortality rate, I should say more accurately. We've decreased the infant mortality rate in Baltimore City by 38%, which is equivalent to 50 babies that would have died in 2009 that are now able to live today. And you know, I think about this now; it's every parent's worst nightmare to have their child die. And
sure.
I chair a committee called the Child Fatality Review, where we look at, it's a state mandated committee, and we look at every case of children who died in Baltimore City. Children who died from homicide and neglect, but also children who died from accidental causes and poisoning and sleep-related infant deaths. And it's so heartbreaking. And we all have to do our part as whatever agency we're part of, or whatever nonprofit we're part of, or as fellow community members, we have to do our part to save lives and talk about the ABCs of safe sleep: alone, on the back, in a crib, no, don't smoke, no exceptions, and really support our women, children, and families.
And it's interesting, you know, there is this inclination for everybody to think, well, you know, giving birth is the most natural thing in the world. It's been going on literally since the beginning of civilization, and women just somehow know how to do this, you know, without anybody telling them, without anybody, you know, sitting them down and saying, here's what you need to figure out. Some families are lucky to be able to go to all sorts of prenatal lectures and films and stuff. I remember when I was an expectant father sitting next to a guy who passed out when they showed a movie of a woman giving birth, you know, and I thought, oh, he's going to be a whole lot of help in about 2 months. You know? But, you know, but not everybody has access to that kind of education, that kind, and those kinds of resources. So the Be More Healthy Babies thing, let's talk about something as simple as sleep. I mean, you rattled off those conditions. Let's do them again, because sleep-related infant deaths are still a problem in this 21st century advanced society of ours. They're certainly still a problem to some extent right here in Baltimore.
And across the country. There are misconceptions about sleep that have lasted over generations. Some people still believe that they should put their babies on their stomachs. And the thought is, well, if babies are spitting up, you'd rather have them spit out rather than regurgitating on their spit. But that's not true. Studies have shown that actually babies sleeping on their backs is much safer and reduces the rate of sleep-related infant deaths. Studies have also shown that babies should be alone, that co-sleeping, sleeping with a parent or with a sibling, and that parent or sibling may roll over on the child or knock the child out of bed, that also increases the rate of injury and death. And we find, when we review the cases of infants dying in their sleep, we find high incidence of co-sleeping. We find high instances of babies put on their stomachs. We also find high instances of babies sleeping with other things in their crib, or even a crib that is there but not being utilized. And there are pillows and blankets all around that may actually suffocate the baby. So that's why teaching about the ABCs of safe sleep is so important. We also, through Be More for Healthy Babies, have people who are credible messengers, people from the communities that we serve, including women who have had infant loss before, because their voices are so powerful and so important. And for them to be spreading the message about ABCs of safe sleep is really critical.
And so you're working with like church groups and mm-hmm. community groups. You're not just doing this through pediatricians' offices or hospitals. You're working with groups in the community.
We believe that every interaction should be a point of intervention. So certainly in the hospital is important. When I delivered at a Mercy Hospital, I had nurses come in who said, did you watch the safe sleep video? Did you watch the safe sleep video? And some of them were rather apologetic and said, I don't want to disturb you in this time, but have you watched the video? I said, no, you're not disturbing me. I'm so happy that you're asking me to watch this video. I'm glad that we're doing this. But absolutely.
But you can imagine mention that, though. The nurse is standing out there. Okay, you go in and tell the health commissioner she's got to watch a movie about safe sleep.
Well, I was so happy that they were all asking us to do this. Absolutely, with our community groups and our neighborhood associations, our faith leaders are also such powerful messengers. And I think that with winter coming, it's another reminder of the importance of teaching the ABCs of safe sleep. Babies should always be alone, on their back, in a crib, no smoking, and no exceptions. And if the temperature is getting cold, don't put blankets around your baby. Dress the baby warmly as you would dress yourself. You can put the baby into a sleep sack, but no loose blankets or pillows in the crib ever.
How about the disparity in infant mortality along racial lines? There for a while was a great disparity between Black and white infant mortality in our city. Where does that stand?
Well, in 2009, an African-American baby born in Baltimore City was 5 times more likely to die than a white baby. In 2009, here in our city, which is an incredible and really startling statistic, we have narrowed that disparity by over 50% in this time period. But there is still a disparity that exists. That disparity, of course, would also persist over socioeconomic lines and is something that we have to commit to. Part of our Healthy Baltimore 2020 plan says that improving health alone is not enough. We also have to be closing that disparity gap, because otherwise we are bending the arc of justice and we're not helping our city overall.
So the other reasons that Be More Healthy Babies, the causes that Be More Healthy Babies, this initiative is trying to address, one of them is premature births. Those kids are have more of a chance of having trouble than the kids who are born at the right birth weight. And birth weight, the low birth weight, is another indicator of an infant that's going to have problems. So what can folks do to alleviate both of those things, and how does this program fit into that?
Well, one thing that we know, again, based on science and data, is the importance of prenatal care, that women who do not get prenatal care are much more likely to have low birth weight babies, premature babies, and are 5 times more likely to have babies who die than women who do get prenatal care. That's why Be More for Healthy Babies is, it emphasizes a life course approach. It talks about, for example, education. We talk about education of girls and women so that we all families can make the best choices for ourselves about when we should be starting a family. That would include teaching on teen pregnancy prevention as well. And then when women are pregnant, to make sure that women get the prenatal care, and that prenatal care and case management then is followed over the course of pregnancy and upon delivery of the child as well. All of this brings us back to the point about what's happening with policy, because services that we provide are dependent on policies at the state, city, state, and federal levels. We just received a massive cut back in July and August from the Department of Health and Human Services for our teen pregnancy prevention program. We were cut $3.5 million in this program, which will affect the services to 20,000 of our students here in Baltimore City. I mean, this is an evidence-based program that works. And that's something that certainly will be impacting prenatal care, that will certainly be impacting the rate of babies who are dying, and the outcomes of families and women later on too. Then I also think about attempts to gut the Affordable Care Act and the attempts to decimate Medicaid. I am so lucky that I had excellent prenatal care. And when my doctor recommended ultrasounds or blood tests, I wouldn't have hesitated to do them. I wouldn't have hesitated when my doctor said come to the hospital for monitoring to do that. If women have to make a choice between caring for the baby they're carrying at this point in time or paying for the rest of their family, I don't know what that says about our values as a society.
The ACA, there's a sign-up period here on the Maryland Health Exchange. We just had Dr. Haft, who was the interim director. They've appointed a new permanent director since his appearance, and he told us information that a lot of folks thought was a little surprising, that the rate of people signing up this year is considerably higher than it was last year. Many more people by a factor of about 100% more people are signing up in this open enrollment period, which is, for a variety of reasons, shorter than the enrollment period has been in previous years, from 3 months down to 6 weeks. Dr. Haff said, actually, it was interesting. He said that that was a choice that the Maryland Health Exchange made. They found that most people sign up early in the process rather than late. So they thought that was okay. I always just thought that was a federal, that was a Trump administration dictate, but it wasn't. But many, many people are signing up for the Affordable Care Act, regardless of all of the rhetoric that is swirling around Washington about how the program is imploding and, it's in a death spiral. That says something very interesting, doesn't it?
I hope that a lot more people will sign up. I was and continue to be worried that there is disinformation about the ACA. We get calls all the time, every day, multiple times a day, from concerned residents in our city wondering if the ACA is still the law of the land, wondering if they still have health insurance. And it's because of what is swirling around and people don't know. And we want everyone to know that we are in open enrollment right now, that everyone should go to MarylandHealthConnection.gov if they don't already have health insurance, that there are health navigators that can help individuals to find the best plan for them. From my standpoint, health is about life. Nobody plans to be sick. Nobody plans for an emergency, a car accident. Nobody plans to get ill. And health insurance protects you, protects your loved ones, it protects those around you. And at a time when there is that rhetoric swirling about the ACA, the best thing that we can do to defend the ACA ourselves, other than to vote and to do what we can as citizens, is to sign up for health insurance ourselves, because that is the most potent way to protect health insurance when we're all in it together.
It's the Midday Health Watch with Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen. She joins us here in Studio A each month to talk about the city's important public health concerns. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation with Dr. Wen and take your calls and comments. 410-662-8780. That's our number here for the Midday Health Watch. Our email, midday@wipr.org, to join the billions and billions of people, as Carl Sagan would say, that join us on Twitter. You can find us at Midday Tom Hall. Stick around.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's the Midday Health Watch. I'm Tom Hall. Dr. Lena Wen is here. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, it's a special pre-Thanksgiving edition of What You Got Cookin' with our resident foodies Sasha Wollhandler and John Shields. He's the chef and co-owner of Gertrude's Restaurant at the Baltimore Museum of Art. So John and Sasha will share their favorite recipes and offer some tips for your Thanksgiving feast. And you can share some of your favorite recipes. Any questions you might have about the big meal, we'll be taking your calls, your emails, your tweets. So be sure to join us tomorrow for a pre-Turkey Day edition of What You Got Cookin'. If you're just joining us today, as I said, it's the Midday Health Watch. Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen joins us here in Studio A every month. We talk about issues affecting public health in our city and beyond. To join our conversation, we'd love to have you. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Lena, we were talking about teen pregnancy. The teen birth rate is actually heading in very much the right direction. It's been decreasing for years. I mean, I think by 2013, 6 or 7 years ago, it was at the lowest it's been historically. But you talked about this program being cut from HHS. There are other challenges that that young families face, and it really is a complicated thing, because the National Women's Law Center, for example, just came out with a study that said there's so many people on the lower income end of the spectrum who can't afford childcare. So they have this baby, they're delighted, the baby's okay and everything's good, they got to go back to work, and they can't do it, or it's very difficult to do it if they don't have a family network that can help them. All of these things, the WIC participation rate for women, infants, and children, this is the Supplemental Nutrition Program, turns out that people in Maryland are taking good advantage of this. There's more people in Maryland. Maryland's the third highest usage of WIC, according to a new report, behind Vermont and California. So people are taking advantage of some of these programs that have traditionally been in place to help them out when they're young parents, when they're starting their families. But boy, you know, with ACA and everything, we talk about this all the time, the interconnectedness of all of this is just unquestionable.
That's right. And I again reflect on how fortunate I am to have a supportive partner, to have resources at my disposal, to have health insurance, and still how difficult caring for a newborn is, and how many other resources I needed and support, and how isolated I felt at times too. I mean, there's so much that we need to do to empower women and to make sure that every child has the best chance at life. Studies have shown that home visiting programs for babies improves educational outcomes for that child even through high school, that it improves the health and well-being of the mom as well as of the baby. These are all things that we need to support. Paid leave is something that we as a country, we're one of two countries, as I understand, in the world that doesn't offer, that doesn't have a national policy of paid paternity and maternity leave. And that's something that is incredible given the plethora of research that's out there about how maternity leave lowers the rate of depression, lowers the rate of maternal illness, lowers the rate of infant mortality. These are all policies that we need to support. And it's not just a matter of choice. So often we hear the rhetoric framed as choice. Oh, you chose to get pregnant, or you're choosing to not go back to work. But that choice is predicated on privilege. And that choice is predicated on the policies that we as a society have set. And for all those individuals, for all of our politicians and all of our leaders who will say that family is important, or women and children are important, or work is important, I'd like them to also support these policies and the funding that comes with it, so that we can really give every child the best chance they have of survival and of well-being.
And it's also connected to one of the things that's very much on top of mind in everybody here in our city, and that is violence and the uptick that we've been noticing over the past several years. You know, certainly at least the last couple of years since the death of Freddie Gray and the uprising that happened subsequent to that, because that, you know, that 18-year-old kid who has been charged, for example, in the murder of Charmaine Mitchell, a woman in East Baltimore who had four children of her own. That 18-year-old kid, and again, he's been charged. We don't know any of the details. I don't even have his name handy. I'm not even sure that's been released by the police. There is a suspect in that shooting. But you think 18 years ago, when he was a newborn, and the prenatal care that his mom may or may not have received, the schooling and the exposure to lead, the mental illness that so many kids growing up in the kinds of neighborhoods that he was growing up in are exposed to, PTSD from the violence that they're surrounded in. You know, it didn't start that afternoon when he walked down the street and made a decision to shoot to death a mother, allegedly. So these things are all connected. The mayor has called for an interagency response to violence. So members of the health department, folks from the police, folks from housing, folks from all different departments, I think there's 17 in all, I guess, have been asked by the mayor to meet every morning at 8 o'clock to come up with a holistic approach. One of the things that they talk about a lot in both the mayor's plan for violence reduction, the public safety committee's plan from the city council, is Safe Streets. This is a program that has been administered by the health department. Remind people what Safe Streets is. And as a physician, as a person who looks at data, as a person who studies this kind of thing, what's the efficacy?
Safe Streets is an offshoot of a national program called Cure Violence, which was started in Chicago by a physician and epidemiologist who studied how violence is a contagious illness. What he found is that violence follows a similar pattern as other contagious diseases, and like another contagious disease, it is something that can be treated and it can be prevented. Safe Streets is based on that public health model of intervening before something happens, of mediating conflict, identifying where those hot spots of violence are and mediating those conflicts. It is evidence-based, it's scientific, it's been shown to be effective in other places and in Baltimore City. And I'm thrilled that Mayor Pugh is looking to expand Safe Streets and to further this public health approach from the vantage point of the mayor's office. It's great that she has embraced this approach as part of the citywide violence reduction initiative.
So you are convinced of this data, this notion that violence, the murders that are taking place in our city and in Chicago and all around the country, can be sort of treated epidemiologically.
There is no question that violence is intimately related to trauma and to violence. I mentioned the Child Fatality Review. We just had a meeting yesterday and looked at cases. Every time we look at cases of children who died, and this time we happen to be reviewing cases of children who, in some cases, died from abuse and neglect. And it's heartbreaking to review these case histories. I mean, some of these children are the same age as my baby. And we look at their records. We look at the stories of what happened, which is horrific. And we think that their caregivers must be some horrible people. But then we look at the case files of their caregivers. And in almost every case, the father, the mother, other caregivers also experienced tremendous trauma in their own lives too, maybe abuse and neglect themselves as children. This does not excuse what they've done, but I think it's also a reminder that it's hurt people who hurt people, and that we cannot just be tackling violence without addressing trauma. And the tenet of public health is about going upstream. There's a fable that you have three friends who are walking along a river, and the first person, and all three begin to see little kids who are dying and are drowning, and the first person jumps in to try to save these kids. The second person sees a dam and runs along further upstream to try to fix the dam. The third person just keeps running, and the first two call out to this person and says, "Why are you running? These kids are drowning right now." And the third person says, "But I want to see who's throwing the kids in the stream in the first place." And that's the nature of public health. We have to focus further upstream. We have to look as upstream as possible. I mean, we see preventing lead poisoning as a violence reduction strategy, getting glasses to children to help them learn and stay in school as a violence reduction strategy, helping our babies thrive and providing every chance for that baby to grow up to be healthy. That's also a violence reduction strategy. And so you're totally right, Tom, that this requires a holistic approach. And the perspective of the health department is to continue that upstream approach and help the narrative about violence being, among other things, also a public health issue.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is the public health official here in Baltimore. She's the head of the health department, our health commissioner. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And to find us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. Very much related, to the violence reduction strategies that the mayor and others are putting into place is the continuing drug problem and the continuing not only the trade of drugs, but in particular the opioid epidemic. And you've been a national leader on this. The Trump administration, their Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis issued a report. They did some measures that were welcomed to a certain extent by you and others in your field, but so many people have criticized the report for not going far enough. On the national level, how's that going to affect the Baltimore City Health Department and the work that you're doing with the still, if I understand it correctly, increasing number of people who are addicted to opioids?
A month ago, President Trump issued what he called a public health emergency. He declared a public health emergency, which sounds good in theory, because there's no doubt that the opioid epidemic is a public health emergency. But by declaring it a limited emergency through the public health declaration rather than a national state of emergency, there were no funds that are available. Actually, not entirely true. It opens up a public health fund, but that public health fund currently contains $57,000 in it for the entire country, which is laughable. I mean, if this were any other state of emergency, let's say that there were a hurricane that were killing 150 people a day, which is the case for overdose, it would be laughable that there would be $57,000 devoted to that hurricane. I mean, we would know that there needs to be money to rebuild bridges or houses or other infrastructure. And that's what we need in the case of the opioid epidemic, too, that we know what works. We just have to have the funding to get there. So I was very disappointed by that, along with my fellow health officials and others in the recovery community. We were hoping that there would be funding associated, because this is a problem for which a solution actually exists. I was also disappointed to see that both the president's commission, chaired by Governor Chris Christie, and the president himself did not acknowledge the role of health insurance in the opioid epidemic. Medicaid, 1 in 3 patients with substance use disorders depend on Medicaid to treat their addiction. If Medicaid were decimated, we're leaving millions of people without coverage. Or private health insurance. Currently, essential health benefits, the provision within the ACA, requires that addiction and substance use and mental health are covered. If that were to be removed, then we're also talking about individuals with private insurance plans who can now lose access to health insurance too. The president has made other potential budget cuts to the NIH, to the CDC, to other entities that directly address the opioid epidemic. And it's important to tie those policy recommendations with the proclamation of a state of emergency. And we in Baltimore City have made a lot of progress with very limited resources. And I would just ask, what more can we do? If we had $1 million, $10 million, imagine how many more lives we can save.
And you save them by intervening, by giving folks alternatives to opioids. I mean, when we talk about treating this as a disease rather than as a crime, and oftentimes the purchase of the opioids is criminal under current statute, but the addiction treatment, it's not like we need to look to brand new research about this, right? I mean, this has been out there for a while, but do you see the political will for addiction treatment? Are you seeing that tide change? I mean, there are so many people who have been reluctant to think of addiction as a treatable medical condition. But I wonder, as this opioid crisis continues to grow, because it gets worse by the month. I mean, it has not begun a downward turn. And this is nationwide, not just here in Baltimore. But are you sensing from the meetings you go to and the folks you talk to that people are understanding the advisability of treating it as a disease?
It's a great question. I do think that the tide is turning, that people are recognizing that the war on drugs hasn't worked, that we have to treat addiction as a disease because, frankly, it is a disease. However, there are still three problems. First is misunderstanding about types of treatments. There are people who will talk about detox, rapid detox, or they'll talk about why is it that people are still on these medications when they've been on them for a year or two. That is misunderstanding the fundamental nature of the disease of addiction. Addiction should be thought about, opioid addiction should be thought the same way as we think about diabetes, that some people may have lifestyle changes alone that can help them, but the evidence shows that there are medications that can help. And we need to accept that medications, some people are in long-term recovery with medications over the course of years. And those are medications like methadone or buprenorphine. So we have to understand addiction as a treatable disease using the gold standard of medication-assisted treatment. Second issue is so often we still focus on the supply of drugs and talk about law enforcement, which is a critical partner in our efforts. But we also have to talk about not just the supply side, but the demand side. As long as there are millions of people who are addicted to drugs, unless we get them treatment, that's going to fuel the supply of drugs. The third thing that I'm getting increasingly concerned about is public education campaigns. I've heard the President Trump talk about the Say No to Drugs campaigns and bringing those back. And they are going to be ineffective unless we also have campaigns to promote general well-being. We cannot have our children be raised in environments where they want to escape the life that they're in. That's when they turn to things like drugs. And so we need to be promoting general health and well-being, alleviating poverty, and investing upstream, because that's ultimately how we're going to stop the addiction epidemic, not just by saying, say no, but improving conditions overall.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about this, and maybe you don't know about this at all, but we last heard Just Say No in the Reagan administration. This was Nancy Reagan's big cause célèbre. Have there been studies conducted about the efficacy of the Just Say No program from the Reagan years? You know, this is 30-something years ago.
There have been studies that look into the effectiveness of certain campaigns like that. Trust for America's Health, for example, released a report about this, and what they found is that those campaigns are not going to be effective unless they are accompanied by these efforts to promote general well-being. And I can see that if you ask.
So this is like the commercial we remember, you know, where the egg goes into the frying pan.
Right.
This is your brain on drugs, that kind of thing.
You know, if you go to any of our classes, any of our middle schools or high schools in Baltimore City, and you ask students, is heroin good or bad? Unless they're trying to be facetious and snarky, the students will say heroin is bad. But what do we do when they see that their parents and caregivers are popping pills? When their parents are getting a prescription narcotic every time they go to their doctor saying that they have tooth pain or back pain. So there's this pill for every pain culture that we have to change. And then we have to ask, what pain is it that we're treating? And if our children have lives where tomorrow is no better than today, maybe that's when they'll start getting addicted to drugs and they're not looking for other opportunities. So it is things like housing and employment and poverty. These are things that we have to work on in order to really stem the tide.
One more quick comment I'd like you to make, and that is, believe it or not, this afternoon is going to be in the 60s. It's awfully balmy here in Baltimore, but we are getting into the code blue season. You're the person who makes the call as to whether it's a code blue day. So when things do get cold, we did a program on homelessness just yesterday with Kevin Lindemood and some other folks. He's with Healthcare for the Homeless. It breaks your heart to be out on the streets when it's so cold and you see people sleeping on the sidewalk. That's, of course, not the whole homeless community, but in a code blue situation, are there things that people can do to help those people who appear to have housing insecurity?
Code blue is the declaration that I, as the health commissioner, issue when the weather reaches a certain point. So it's either 13 degrees Fahrenheit or it's not quite there, but there are other conditions that necessitate an additional response. Part of that response is by the Mayor's Office of Human Service, which provides services for our individuals experiencing homelessness. There are also additional things that other city agencies assist with, for example, distributing meals to at-risk senior citizens and providing home weatherization services by the Department of Housing and Community Development and other things. And so Code Blue, the declaration, triggers a number of responses by other city agencies. There are a lot of things that we can start doing now to help those who are the most vulnerable, including those experiencing homelessness, but also including many of our neighbors. We should make sure that in our own homes that we have working carbon monoxide and fire detectors and smoke detectors. Those are things that we should also help our neighbors with, especially if you have an elderly neighbor or a neighbor who may be in need of additional support. And this is also the time to prepare for when things get very cold for hypothermia. So make sure that you always dress in layers. Make sure that if there are infants, that they don't get wrapped in loose blankets. And in general, to get ready, because things could get cold very soon.
Yeah, who knows? We'll have to see. Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen, thank you so much. It's always good to see you. Known, by the way, in certain quarters as Eli's mom. And tell Eli hello from all of us at Midday, and tell him he's a lucky little dude. He's got a good mom and dad.
We're very lucky to have him. And thank you so much for having me on. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you as well. Dr. Lena Wen, coming up after a short break, theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us. She's got a review of the new production of Tina Fey's Mean Girls, the musical. It's at Washington's National Theater. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.